Good evening, everyone. Welcome on this chilly Monday night. We'd like to acknowledge the custodians of the land, the Yalakut Wilam clan and the Boon Wurrung peoples. We pay our respect to their elders, both past and present, and welcome you here tonight. My name's Neil Drinan, and I'm going to be talking to this wonderful fellow here. I'd just like to say tonight we're all going to enjoy a moment more of a time long gone, a time many of us didn't think we'd live through. I certainly didn't think I'd make old bones, and I've decided this is old bones. I certainly didn't think we'd make it through the fever dream of desire and disease that accompanied the 80s and the 90s. The dazzle of carnal delusion was too much of a fantasy for many of us. And I wish I had the temperance then that I have now. Tonight, we have the great pleasure of meeting Greg Johnson, who was quite literally the canary in the coal mine of Sydney's Oxford Street during the 80s and 90s. He was the pharmacist in his own chemist store right at the heart of Taylor Square. He knew where the bodies were hidden, or more often, what they were hiding. He knew the sex workers, the drug dealers, those using and needing syringes, and most crucially, he could see who was trying to manage the terrifying medicinal challenges of HIV and AIDS long before the millennium brought us the drugs that made HIV manageable. In the late 80s and early 90s, 1,000 people were dying each year in Australia from HIV, from AIDS. In the years between 1996, when I moved to Sydney, in 2010, when I was working and writing in Sydney, Greg had sold the pharmacy and we'd become regular pals. Mm. He had been working on some wonderful books, a script like Sweet Bitter Cane, Consumption and the Cast of a Hand, as well as his, as well as sharing with me his passion to fully realise his ambitions as a writer. Originally from Hobart, Greg currently lives in Sydney. He is the treasurer of the Historical Novel Society of Australia and hosts their podcast, Imagining the Past. He is living history himself, as his wonderful book does attest. This book, for a moment more, will enshrine his place, I believe, in queer literary history. It certainly deserves to. It chronicles a time that was initially immortalised in Australia, I guess, by Tim Conagrave's Holding the Man, and in USA by Tony Kushner's Angels in America. It seemed for a long time there were more casualties than survivors from AIDS, but Greg's book tells the story of what it took for one man to survive, physically and socially. Chris, our struggling protagonist and hero, is an adorable gay man who will remind many of us of our youth or that of someone we knew. Chris is the star of the show tonight, as well as his daddy, Greg. Please welcome him.
Thank you.
There's a wonderful passage in Angels in America that sums up in so many ways our desire for a moment more. It goes like this. I don't know if it's not braver to die, but I recognize the habit, the addiction to being alive. So we live past hope. If I can find hope anywhere, that's it. That's the best I can do. It's so much, not enough. It's so inadequate, but still, bless me. Anyway, I want more life. Greg's book made me think of this many times, but it stands on its own. It's Kylie, it's Frankie Goes to Hollywood, it's Barbara Streisand, it's an Aussie gay blessing all of its own. So is this your literary love child?
I'm not sure I know what that means. Is this my literary love child? I guess it's an amalgam of a lot of things, but it's odd to hear my book mentioned alongside Angels in America, that's for sure. So, yeah, it is, I guess I bought many things together and fused them to try and make something else. So, yeah, it is a love child.
And I guess one of the the things that I'd really like to know. I mean, we talked a lot about things in the past, you and me, but it would be very interesting to know a bit about the differences between you and Chris. And he came off the farm in Victoria. You came from Hobart. Do you want to just talk a bit about how you kind of developed him?
He's definitely not me, but I definitely took parts of my life, and that coming from a smaller place into Sydney was, you know, an easy thing for me to write about, that transition. But he arrived in 78. I didn't arrive in Sydney till 83. And so I think that is quite a different thing. I don't think I've ever written a character that's based on one person, because as you write and you put them in different situations, I always find other things that have happened maybe to other people that I can reapply to my character. So, I mean, he's definitely not me. I'd like to think he has, or maybe I should like to think I've got his sense of humor, but yeah, I would like to think he has my sense of humor, so.
He's got a sense of humour, but also he came from a family background that was, you know, was quite difficult. He wasn't rejected entirely by his family, but he certainly was by his father. Did you kind of have that sort of experience yourself as a young man?
Well, it was very difficult being gay in Tasmania, you know, growing up in the 70s and early 80s. I don't know when I moved away from Tasmania that I had this idea that I was, you know, going to Oz to find the wizard kind of thing. I don't know that I did think that. But it was very difficult for me. I mean, my family were quite conservative, and it was very difficult to eventually come out to them. So I guess I share that, but his experience is much more exaggerated than mine was.
So in a way, you didn't know whether you were running away from something or towards something. And
yeah, I just knew I was running, I think.
I guess Tasmania has changed a lot, as well, like everywhere. So much of the experience of gay men with HIV at that time revolved around medication and side effects, and taking sometimes up to 50 tablets a day. It's very interesting because you haven't had to take all of those medications, but absolutely you could see every step of the way that medicine's evolved and what happened through those years. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you learnt about the HIV virus and the AIDS experience through having the chemist and being a pharmacist?
Well, I remember when the first day I went to work at the pharmacy being quite shocked at that, you know, I guess to a certain degree I'd been protected from it, but going from a suburban pharmacy to that pharmacy in the middle of Oxford Street, I was shocked by the number of people and the age of the people, because I'd gone from an experience of pharmacy which was pretty much geriatric pharmacy in the suburbs to these very young men, and they were all walking out of the pharmacy with bags of medication. So it was like these men had become old men overnight, you know, in terms of being in the pharmacy. I guess some of the other shocks were when people I knew came in and would hand their prescriptions in, and I'd look at it and go, oh, okay, so you've got HIV. So that was quite a shock for me with a number of people, and there were a few awkward moments that we had to kind of negotiate, which I didn't ever feel. I mean, I never felt any prejudice, but it is a revelation when someone tells you something like that. So there was a few situations like that. But I guess the other stuff, that pharmacy all of a sudden became much more kind of innovative, really, in that it was because the medicines that were so basic and so raw, there was so much that had to be done to try and keep these people going. So even simple things, like I remember when the drug rep told me about a gastrolyte, you know, those sachets you mix up in water for electrolytes, which people with HIV had to take because they had chronic diarrhea, which was induced by a lot of the drugs they were taking. And he said that they'd just produce this one that had rice flour in it. And I remember thinking, well, that would really soak up a lot of, you know, excess fluid in the gut. So I rang one of the doctors in the area and said, you know, this has just come out. I think it would be worth trying. And so she prescribed it for some people, and it really did help to bind their stomachs together. So there were a lot of little things like that that really, you know, we were always on the outlook for what we could find to try and solve some problem.
And you were solving problems as quickly as the drug regimes changed as well, I guess.
Yeah, that, I mean, it was a very dynamic situation, particularly as it went on towards 96, and people were on trials that were presenting with other side effects as the newer range of drugs became available in this country. Yeah.
Chris, in the book, his story is very much of a young gay man who had, I guess, a great time in the 80s, and we kind of come into his life when he's 33, isn't he? Mm. And the wheels are starting to fall off. And it's happening at the beginning of the 90s, which was a crucial time for the development of HIV medications and very close to the beginning of protease inhibitors and some of those. So he, a lot of this book is about his journey in trying to find the right thing and follow the right path. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of, there's a huge range of people who had HIV clearly, and a huge range of education, a huge range of just basic capacities. But on top of that, I think there were people with a huge range of just different genetic constitutions, which not only handled the disease better, but handled the treatments better. So Chris kind of comes to this realization that if he wants to get through to the point where effective therapy arrives, he really has to take care of himself and he really has to take control of the whole situation. But he's a bright boy and he had the capacity to do that, whereas a lot of other people I met through the pharmacy really just didn't have that capacity to take control themselves. So, I mean, that was one of the startling things that I think came out of HIV, that people became part of their therapeutic team and took responsibility for things, which really renegotiated and changed the whole discourse of medicine, really. And I think one of the prime examples of that was when there was this shift from people being a victim of HIV to living with HIV. And I remember when that happened, just thinking, wow, that's an amazing thing to shift your focus from being this victim to living with is so much more positive, pardon the pun. And it just fostered that thing that you can live with this and actually survive. And that, you know, where, how many times a week do you hear that phrase now of someone is living with cancer or living with, you know, psychiatric illness or something? It really changed the way we look at people who are unwell.
And also a lot of Chris's story is about how you kind of navigate life in what superficially is this incredibly kind of hedonistic world of lots of sex and party drugs and all of that sort of stuff. As well as keeping your own health, or his health in this case, because clearly not everyone did. And one of the fascinating, some of the fascinating threads in the stories are, it was never a level playing field. You didn't know who was going to win or lose that battle. And in a way, you know, the characters that you've created around him, it's, you just don't know where it's going to go. Do you think that the people who kind of lived for the moment were the ones who didn't last, or?
Oh, I could never say that. I mean, I think, you know, there is definitely genetic constitution really came into play with this, you know, and that really comes down to, like, you know, someone I knew through work, I used to say to him he had the constitution of an ox, because it just, nothing he took seemed to rattle him, whereas the person next to him was, you know, flawed with diarrhea or whatever. So I don't think you can draw that kind of line, but I just think on a pragmatic level that if you just took it off the boil for a couple of years and, you know, behaved a little bit better and looked after yourself, you were giving yourself a better chance to get through to that. And there were definitely people at work who I suggested that to, and they did not, you know, take that advice, and they died before things got better. So, but, you know, I would never say that, you know, that you had to do that. But it just made sense to me at the time that if you just looked after yourself, you had to be increasing your odds.
Yeah. And, you know, it was uncertain how quickly new generations of drugs would come and whether, you know, whether you could hold out. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, some people, I guess, you know, it's like a war. Some people died so close to the end of it. Mm. If they'd lasted a bit longer, they would have lasted a lot longer.
So yeah, well, I think that's a very good point, that it wasn't like there was a date that it was all going to change. And so, you know, the 1st of July 1996 was the date that it was going to all get better. Like, that wasn't on the horizon. It was just this hope. And, I mean, it was beyond hope. There was movement. There were things happening that were suggesting this. But, you know, there wasn't a fixed date. So it was like COVID. It was really like COVID. If we'd all been told, well, you're going to be in lockdown to this date and then the whole thing's going to be over, it would have been a lot better. But that uncertainty of getting through one lockdown and then, you know, a couple of weeks later there's another one was the thing that was crushing people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's an element of the book. It's a bit like an escape room in a way, because there's these other characters. There's people for Chris to long after and fall in love with, and there's all sorts of fascinations and dynamics around, you know, not knowing whether someone has HIV and people haven't disclosed it, and suddenly he finds that someone really fancies him after he's gone through a whole period of thinking, you know, I'll never have sex again because of all of this, and I've got too much to deal with. So that's kind of one of the lovelier things about the story is how he kind of, well, he finds love in different ways, doesn't he?
I think that's one of the gifts of redrafting when you write a book that, you know, I think in the original drafts he probably didn't discover that. But it was literally, you know, one of those things, this character just came in and stamped their feet and demanded to be on the page kind of thing. And once I had done it, it just made absolute sense. And then the more I played with it, the more it became a lovely romance, you know, which I hadn't kind of envisaged putting in it, you know, because he is a late character in it. It's not like he starts at the beginning. And so, yeah, that was kind of one of the fun things of writing it, really, of just having this character come in and just demand to be on stage, kind of.
And also, in some ways, compared to a lot of the people around him, he's quite an innocent. Like he was quite sort of faithful and potentially monogamous, you know, earlier on. And like so many people, was sort of fell victim to circumstances that he didn't know about until it was too late.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, though, I mean, that's probably an overlap for myself, because I think when I first got to Sydney and, you know, like, what's that line in the Richard Clapton song? You're like a boy at a big store window, you know, and it was just completely overpowering. But I think in those initial years, I felt pretty burned off pretty quickly and retreated for a while, because it just, it was just too much, really. Like, and, you know, kind of almost bordering on violent at times, not physically violent, but just the way the pendulum would swing with things was just too violent for me. And I just kind of withdrew, because I just didn't enjoy that kind of hurdy-gurdy ride of it, really.
I think one of the things that fascinates me now, perhaps more historically than I was aware of at the time, but the fact that, you know, at a time where we were in such a health crisis and a contagious health crisis, we also had this incredible demanding culture of liberty and this kind of male sexuality that wanted to have whatever it wanted, and somehow those two things existed together.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting kind of side effects of HIV, because I think when I first heard about HIV in 83 or 84, I just kind of thought, oh, well, that's the end of it. You know, that's any liberty that's been won is gone. And then the fight back was so hard, as you kind of said, that people just gathered momentum. And it, I think the whole, and particularly too, in by the mid-80s, the lesbian and the gay community had really come back together after the huge cleaves of the kind of late 70s. And that, you know, brought everyone together to fight together for HIV. But then the processes and the organisations and all of those kinds of things were put in place to be able to lobby on further. So it really did, as you say, you know, people just demanded what they needed there.
Do you think that health crisis brought, you know, gay men and lesbians closer together? Do you think that strengthened our relationship?
Yeah, there's that scene in the book which was real, that after Fred Nile had staged the cleansing march of Oxford Street, which was just this awful day. Well, it wasn't actually, because we all went to the pub after this. But the actual event, like, I remember this truckload of Islander people were on the back of a truck, and people were screaming, like they were outnumbered probably 5 or 10 to 1. So, you know, it was just this huge crowd on the street screaming at these people as they were going up Oxford Street. And, that kind of the day or two after that, which I kind of used in the novel, Kath Phillips, who was the head of Mardi Gras at that time, was on the Anna Benz program, whatever that was at that time, with Fred Nile. And, you know, Fred Nile made some comment about that he had installed all these portaloos on Taylor Square for the Christians to use, but, you know, the gays and lesbians use the toilets. And so the Christians were horrified and couldn't use the toilets after that. And Yana Vent went him, just absolutely went him. And he kind of retreated a bit. And then Kath Phillips came in, and I couldn't find the bit of footage for this. And I tried to get on to Kath Phillips to see if she would let me use it. But she said to Fred Nile, Fred, you're more likely to catch this than I am. And he just like collapsed, you know. It was just, and only a lesbian could come out with that to Fred Nile.
And I guess throughout the book and throughout the real history, there's this incredible power of things like Mardi Gras to send all of this stuff up. I mean, at the height of the AIDS crisis, you still had Mardi Gras, which was at least presenting bodies as perfect and carrying, you know, politicians and Pauline Hansons and various figures down the road. Do you think that was, you know, do you think that there's an underlying kind of humour, the camp, the Barbara Streisand, the things that kind of keep Chris buoyant are a big part of what keeps us going?
Well, I think, I think the humour and the naughty men and people that I met during it, you know, I've never met people who were so funny, really, and they were sick as dogs. And they would still come out with a one-liner that just floored you. And within the first few weeks of working there, someone had died. I didn't know who it was. And everyone from the pharmacy had gone to the funeral, and they came back. And he'd been an actor, and he'd demanded that his casket have a curtain call, which, you know, on one hand, I thought was so sad, but on the other hand, I just thought it was so funny. So I ended up using that in the book because I just thought it was a great example of this kind of black humor that came with it. And there were things like, there was a very naughty man who I won't name, who used to produce this guerrilla newspaper called The Daily Plague that was just absolutely terrible but hysterical.
Yep.
Like, and I mean, it was all done anonymously. If he'd been found out, he would have been dragged to every court in the country, I think, but it was hysterical. Like, I've still got a couple of copies at home, and I wanted to use it, but I just thought, no, I can't.
It was a bit like a Viz magazine, that sort of thing. I'm having recollections.
It was so naughty.
Yeah. and so getting back to some of these therapies, there's moments in the book where Chris meets naturopaths. There's all sorts of theories and ideas roaming around, and I remember this myself. I remember people who were quite adamant that they would never go on to, you know, take any HIV drugs or whatever. Some of them didn't need to, others didn't. What were your feel like as someone who was like looking at the provision of drugs and things like that? What did you feel about all of those alternative therapies back in the day?
To a certain degree, I kind of had a anything and everything kind of response because, you know, a placebo effect is never to be discounted. But I thought they had to be used clearly and openly, like it needed to be discussed what people were doing. But I don't think I ever got to the point of thinking that, you know, they had no role in it at all. And I think the HIV community generally were very supportive of it, even in the magazine that the HIV community produced called Talk About.
Yeah.
There was always alternative therapies. And there were, we used to make a tea that had a lot of ginger and sugar in it, which was really great for nausea. Like it really settled down nausea. And so one of the partners in the pharmacy used to make that up. But I think where it became problematic when people started arguing very strenuously that the HIV drugs were the thing that were causing AIDS. And I found that very difficult. And they were the HIV drugs that were first on the market were making people very unwell, but they were active against the virus. They only had a limited span of use, but they were active against the virus. So I found that kind of stuff a bit hard. And I also found it hard with the really militant people who believed in natural therapy, because it was just kind of, it's my way or the highway kind of thing. And I just thought that was really wrong to be preaching to people if they wanted to take the drugs that were being provided, that they were somehow wrong and that this was better. And those kinds of arguments were going on in the community.
And there's a number of characters who are within the book, including Chris himself, but other characters, Gino, you know, had even more kind of traumatic backstories, coming out stories, family rejection stories. You know, how much do you think that played into the kind of the vulnerability that people had as gay men, in terms of their behaviour or their resilience, those sorts of things? Is that something you had a theory on?
Well, I mean, those stories were based in things that I had been told and people, friends that I knew. And I think the line in the book where he says he's never met a gay man who doesn't have shame coming out of every pore, like, you know, teenage acne. Like the shame that we were made to feel was pretty hard to shake off, and I think people could shake it off for, you know, a couple of months in a good situation, and then it would just come back and bite you. And I think for myself that took a long, long while to get to a point where, I mean, maybe I do still feel shame, I don't know, but I don't feel like it impacts on my life. Whereas to be shameful of your sexuality and then shameful of the fact that you have HIV is just a double whammy, and the side effects of that were, I think, are unchartable really in people.
Mm. And also people like Tom who, you know, were just kind of wildly promiscuous and just unable to settle. And you know, do you think that sort of rampant promiscuity is a byproduct of all of that sort of stuff?
Well, again, you can't draw a complete conclusion, but in Tom's case, it was a product of his upbringing, what had happened to him, how he felt portrayed. And, you know, there was a slight bit of Joe Orton in him as well, of just, well, if I'm going to be told I'm wrong, I'm going to be very wrong.
Yeah.
So, I think he was another type of person. And there are definitely people I know who are kind of, you know, for want of a better word, incapable of forming a close relationship with someone. But they've got to a point where they're not actually looking for that anymore. And I mean, Tom's happy. Like, Tom is essentially a very happy character, and he's incredibly supportive of Chris, but he just has this different way of living in the world. So it's functional. He holds the job down. He does everything. He has long-term friendships and everything, but he just gets to a point where he just says, I'm just not cut out for this. So he just stops looking for it.
One of the things, you know, that the fabulous things that happen throughout the book is remembering this time in the 90s, and where every Mardi Gras or every sleazeball had a special secret entertainer. Will it be Kylie? You know, it was all of these sorts of things throughout that time. Is that sort of still a thing? Is that kind of annual ritual of life in Sydney still going?
You're asking me, do you?
But you're just a bit more close geographically to it than I am. I mean, we sometimes watch the Mardi Gras on the telly these days.
Yeah, well, we've fallen asleep watching it. I really can't answer that, but I think the last one got called off. The party got called off because the surprise guest was going to be pulled out or something. So I'm not quite sure whether they were then scared they weren't going to get ticket sales, but it was a surprise guest, so I don't know what happened. But it's very sad. I think that Mardi Gras seems to be at this point unraveling again, and you know, maybe it served its function. I mean, you walk down Oxford Street now, and you know, I very rarely do it, but you know, I sometimes feel like I'm the only gay man walking down Oxford Street. And it's just that community is just not there anymore for a lot of reasons, which I think include the fact that we don't have to huddle together now in a ghetto. People are living everywhere and can live everywhere. So there's not that need of a central place like that. But it's sad because it did have, you know, there were really upsides to having a community like that, in the same way that, you know, you go to Harris Park in Sydney and, you know, there's the most amazing Indian restaurants this side of Bombay. So it's kind of, you know, that those ghettos are really lovely, but I think the gay ghetto is just not needed anymore.
Or it's a sort of virtual thing on chat sites or on dating apps.
Yeah, I think that's, those have got a lot to answer for in terms of bar culture and things like that, because they're just not needed now.
Yeah, yeah. And so thinking about the life that Chris has had and continue to have until COVID, well, he still had it beyond COVID, but you kind of draw some parallels there between what it was to live through one and then make it all the way to 2020. What sort of parallels do you think there were between, you know, the experience of AIDS and COVID?
Well, I mean, initially the whole response to COVID did set off some depth charges for me, like just hearing words like, you know, having tested positive and seroconverting, hearing these words again really reminded me that I had kind of forgotten about it. And then speaking to other people, particularly younger people in their early 30s, about HIV and AIDS, and they'd just go, I don't know anything about it, kind of thing. But with COVID, I think Australia really was very lucky because we had this model of a health model which was very easily reapplied to COVID that came from HIV. So I think that, you know, when HIV happened, the whole thing had to be generated, like even down to, you know, we didn't really have very much information about how an immune system worked when HIV happened. So when COVID happened, there was all that information about how the immune system works. There was even all that information about developing these vaccines, which had come out of the HIV vaccine, which got shelved and never was finished. So, but just the abject fear of this thing descending on everyone again, like, was, and seeing doctors wrapped up in plastic trying to to administer to people, all of that stuff I found really re-triggering. So.
And when do you think that, like, the pivotal moment was in the 90s where we went from this sort of death culture to a positive living culture?
Well, it was 30 years ago this month. There was a conference in Vancouver in Canada where triple therapy, so, you know, what we now call heart therapy, which is highly active antiretroviral therapy, was announced to be the standard therapy and the best possible therapy. So once that model, which basically meant you had to administer three anti-HIV drugs at the one time, which gave you a 1+1+1=10 kind of effect, and actually reduced the replication of the virus to zero. So technically that meant you weren't going to get any resistance from the virus to the drugs, because it couldn't actually replicate to breed up resistance. So I was actually out of the country when that conference happened. And then by the time we got back, which is about a month later, I think, you know, maybe this is a gilded memory, but I think therapies had become more available because there had been people on trials. But it just seemed very quickly that these skeletons kind of bloomed into little cherubs again, you know, and it was very rapid, I thought.
And also the fatigue experienced by sort of medicos and healthcare workers. And I'm sure there's one doctor in there, an English doctor who smokes a lot, who I'm sure I know who she was based on, because I interviewed her once about something. What did you see in terms of stresses around that during that time? Because you kind of characterize some of these doctors throughout the novel as obviously having to be compassionate, but there you can see they don't even know where this is going a lot of the time.
Well, definitely initially they were just grappling, but I think there were definitely doctors who were courageous, and there were definitely doctors who got involved in overseas trials early on, which meant that they, you know, they could administer these drugs to people, even though they're only a small cohort of people who could receive them. So again, I think that kind of re-jigged or changed the way that medicine was practiced, in that it became international. Because I remember a doctor getting connected to the internet, which must have been like 96 or 97, and he was just kind of like, this is it, because he then was connected to everybody else that was doing stuff about HIV in real time. So that was a huge turning point in it as well. I think that the information highway really was used to just gather information from anywhere. So, yeah, not sure what that is.
And I think the other thing we talked a bit about was like the families that we create when we leave our biological families and become a queer person or whatever. These families are kind of linked by quite fragile kind of networks, and you look at that a bit in Chris is very reliant on these networks that he's built up. How effective do you think we are at building those new families as when we kind of go outside the heteronormative model?
Well, given the audience tonight, I feel kind of guilty about saying being negative, but I think we all do build up these networks. But I think when you're younger, I mean, I definitely was when I was younger. I mean, I think I was called Greg for a reason, that I was incredibly gregarious and just needed a lot of people in my life. And I thought that a lot of people made me feel secure. But as I've got older, I think I still have a lot of people I have known for a very long time. Like, there's a lot of people here tonight who I've known for a very long time. So, you just, I think they're important, those families, but I think I don't like to actually call them family in a way. I don't know. But yeah, I think they're important, but it's important to be realistic with people that often people change, and often people change geographical circumstances, which then changes the way you interact with them. And people get older and people get crotchety, and, you know, but it's important to, I think I try to hang on to fewer people, but I hang on to them tighter.
You know, one point towards the end, you know, Chris says, you know, have I stayed too long at the fair? There's that whole question about, you know, what price survival. But there are a great many people still around, certainly in Sydney, and I certainly knew some who did make it through, you know, who perhaps didn't, who weren't undamaged physically by the virus. But you know, do you know many people who are like Chris?
Yeah, he's definitely based in people I know, and people who've told me their stories. Because I don't go out in that area that much now, and I don't probably see a lot of people, but when I think I put in the acknowledgement that one of the triggers to write the novel was we went to a restaurant one night, and this man came up and said hello to me, and I looked at him and thought, oh, who are you? And then he told me who he was, and the first thing I was going to say was, oh, Christ, you're still alive. But I managed not to. And but, you know, I just looked at him and I just thought, you're just an older man now, you know, and that's amazing that you went from being a skeleton to be just an old man in a restaurant. So,
And, of course, HIV is, I mean, invisible largely now, and also with all of the drugs that people can take to prevent contracting it, it's, I guess, still a thing, but I don't know. Do you know much about how the younger people feel about HIV in your researching for this? Have you
I was surprised. Like a couple of years ago, I remember walking up Oxford Street, and there was this drop-in clinic on Oxford Street, which just, you know, surprised me that this stuff now was so low cost and so kind of available, that people could just drop in for PrEP and things. I mean, people are still seroconverting. I think it's wrong to kind of think they're not. I think in the inner city, it's pretty low, but I think as you get out into the outskirts of Sydney or any big city, I'm sure people are still seroconverting. But, you know, HIV has become, you know, a problem of the third world now, really, and it's women in the third world, which is why what Trump has done recently by cutting the funding to fund drugs in the third world is so reprehensible, because the amount of money in reality that was being spent on those drugs, particularly given that drug companies had actually come to the party and provided generic drugs at cheaper prices, is just completely reprehensible. So, yeah, it is a disease now of the third world, really. So that's the fight now, really.
So you want to just tell us a bit about what we're going to love about Chris and his journey? I mean, what's the triumph of it all for you?
Well, when I started to think about writing it, I mean, there's clearly a lot of things that were written very early on, like Tim Conagrave, The Normal Part and Angels in America. I mean, how someone wrote Angels in America when they were in the middle of it and surrounded by it all happening is just kind of hard to imagine how he could do that. But all of those stories were by their nature kind of quite depressing, in that, you know, you kind of knew in Tim Conagrave's you were reading, you know, Romeo and Juliet, and they were both going to die, kind of. So when I started writing it, or thinking about writing it, I thought this period was much more interesting on two levels, because it was the period where most people died. Like, you know, you will remember the Star Observer every fortnight just had pages and pages of obituaries, which shocked me when I went back to read them again. like I again immune myself to laughing a bit, but that shocked me. So that was one thing that I found interesting, that this was the worst period of it, but it also ended in, it had the chance of ending in a positive ending, which I thought was something new for an HIV novel, to that it actually does end positively. And he's not, you know, he's scarred, like, you know, he's wearing some scars, but he has survived, which is what he said he wanted to do at the beginning of the novel.
Well, I just want to say about 3 years ago when you sent me the manuscript, I was so thrilled that you did, and I was so thrilled that you've made all of this happen, because it's such a wonderful story. So can we just all give Greg a huge hand, because it's quite a journey.
Thank you. You don't be there enough for that.